Thanks for joining us for part 7 of the Little John interview.
Do you feel that the death penalty has a deterrent effect, or is it beneficial for society?
I do, and I never debate the matter because there is involved an emotional issue. It's sort of like divorce or corn liquor. People have deep convictions, and they aren't easy to convince, so I don't debate it. I merely say this, that capital punishment will not stop all wrongful killings. But if capital punishment were promptly invoked, every now and then you would have an individual who would say, I want to kill him, but they might electrocute me, so I'm not going to kill him. And so I leave it at that. I would not abolish capital punishment if I could. I think it is a deterrent, but I have that conviction. I cannot prove it, and I don't attempt to prove it. I got a conviction, and I'm willing to proceed on the basis of my conviction.
Speaking of the criminal side of the court, I read an article you wrote for the Bar News paper about gun control and crimes using guns versus other crimes, physical crimes, that I think you espouse the point that it was just so much easier for someone to shoot somebody as opposed to harming them physically in other ways. Do you recall the article
I do. You know, I've written that article 101 times. I've written it about everything known to man. And one time I wrote about gun control. I'm in favor of strict gun control. I was in favor of the Brady Bill, though the Brady Bill was just a drop in the bucket. It really didn't do a whale of a lot to bring about gun control.
Why do you feel that gun control would be, why are you in favor of it? I mean, is it based on your experience to the court system?
I think that if you had gun control, well, I'll put it this way. I've tried a good many cases, sent one person to the penitentiary and the other to the mortuary because a gun was too easily available. Now, my prime example of it is a capital case I tried in Spartanburg. Man was living with this girlfriend. They quarreled. He woke up the next morning and she was gone. He was furious. So he went downtown looking for her, and he went to a pawn shop and bought a pistol. Wouldn't work. Went back and got his money. Walked across the street to another pawn shop and bought a pistol. It would work. He found her sitting in a Chevrolet automobile across the street from the courthouse in Spartanburg. He went to the right front door and shot her. She was sitting under the steering wheel. She opened the door and fell to the ground. He walked around the car and pumped 4 more bullets into her body lying there on the ground. I tried him. Jury did not recommend mercy. They ordered him to the execution. Within 6 months, he was executed. All because a gun was too easily available. That's one of my most pronounced examples of a gun being too easily available. Incidentally, at my house, there were 5 boys. My daddy never would have a gun of any sort in the house. He said, it's just too easy. So the boys might get mad at each other and do something rash. So he just eliminated and said, no gun in my house at all. But I would not, in my gun control theory, I would not deny people the right to have a gun in their house for their home protection. My conviction doesn't go that far.
When you tried death penalty cases, did the judge actually pass the death sentence, or was it passed by did the jury bring back a recommendation? You just said without mercy, which meant the defendant would get the electric chair, or did the judge have a role in his sentence?
Well, there were two verdicts you could return. Guilty, period. That meant death by electrocution in this state. Or guilty with recommendation to mercy, which automatically meant a life sentence. We on the bench took a lot of comfort in the fact that we did not make the final determination. The final determination was spread out among 12 people who composed the jury. I, as circuit court judge, was the instrumentality of the state, which put the sentence into effect, but I did not make the determination. Even so, it's a gruesome chore to sit there in your black robe pomposity and tell a man he's got to die on a certain day. I did it 9 times.
Chief Justice, of course, in South Carolina, we have a history where lynchings have occurred. Did you ever try a lynching case?
No, I never tried a lynching case. It is my recollection that the last lynching case tried in this state was 2 years before I went on the bench. It was in 1947. Some people took a prisoner from the Pickens County Jail, as best I can recall, and killed him. They tried a number of people in the Greenville County Court, Court of General Sessions there. The jury found him not guilty. Now, I had one experience I'll tell you about. I was coming back from somewhere in the Low Country, coming through Union in 1937 or 8, along there somewhere. Town was full of people milling about the street on the courthouse lawn. We stopped to inquire what's cooking. We learned that some people had lynched a man out in the county, and everybody had come to town just milling around. As best I can remember, they were never able to find any witness to testify in that case, and nothing ever came of it. But that was in the late 30s, before I had just been a lawyer a year or two. But the answer to your question is I did not try any case which involved a lynching.
The juries sat in your courtroom when you were a circuit court judge, were they all male, or did you hold circuit court after women began to be allowed to serve on the jury?
No, when I was a circuit court judge, the code said the jury will be composed of men. And so if a woman's name were drawn out of the jury box, clerk court and the treasurer and auditor, they were the jury commissioners, they just put the name back in. Women were not eligible to serve. Then it was in the middle 60s, as best I can remember, the United States Supreme Court held that juries had to be composed of a cross-section of the populace, including women. Now, women had been serving in federal court and in many states prior to that time, but it caused a lot of pandemonium in South Carolina. And so I never had a female juror. It is significant that the first women who served on the jury in South Carolina served the week after I went on the Supreme Court.
Is that a fact?
And some of my friends said that the reason they changed it was that when I was a circuit judge, said, "Judge, they just didn't trust you with women." But it was the week after, which would have been, I believe in March of 1967, that women first came to serve on the jury. In that regard, every now and then I trickle into the jury court in Spartanburg. It's not unusual to have more women on the jury than there are men. And I think they're doing a good job serving on the jury. It's a plus for the system, in my opinion. But it's not unusual. Very few blacks were serving on the jury back then. Every now and then in some counties in this state, you'll have 12 jurors who are all black, just as you used to have 12 jurors who were all white. So it does happen, particularly in the counties like Beaufort, Williamsburg, and Winnsboro, where the black population is in the majority.
What were the pleasures of service as a circuit court judge?
Well, the best thing about being a judge of any sort is that people who hate you are nice to you. So, when I became Chief Justice, I remember telling Speaker of the House, Raymond Swartz from Sumter, I said, Raymond, you know, since I got to be Chief Justice, the lawyers are laughing louder at my jokes. And he said, Judge, they're definitely more funny now. back to your question. To be a judge has certain amount of prestige with it. And so people are sometimes pay you tribute that you don't deserve. Sometimes we hope we do deserve it. But it sort of Judge Cease, whom I succeeded, said, Judge Bruce said, now that you're a judge, said, you're on a pedestal. He said, you got to watch your conduct a little more carefully. Said, used to be you could say something, nobody pay any attention to it. He said, now you're quotable. Said, you're a judge. And says, people love to quote you, and sometimes they'll quote you to your embarrassment. Not that you're going to say anything is worth quoting, but says, they just like to do it. It's sort of name-dropping, he says. They like to advertise the fact they've been associated with the judge. I found that to be true.
Be good advice.
Yeah.
Did you find frustrations in the job of a circuit judge? And how do you see the circuit judges now? It seems that you mentioned there are many more demands on their time and work.
Well, a trial judge has great responsibility. If you get frustrated, you can't let it last too long. You can't bleed your heart out for every mother's son who happens to be in trouble. If you bled your heart out for every mother's son in trouble, you would lose your effectiveness and you couldn't do a good job. And so you have serious problems, but you have to solve them as best you can and pass on to another problem.
In your work on the circuit court bench, I've lost this question. Let me ask you this. The bar is so much larger now. We have so many more judges, and it doesn't seem that we have quite the amount of social contact with our judges that we did even when I started 20 years ago. When you were serving as a circuit court judge, was there a closeness that, was that part of the pleasure of the role of a judge, with the lawyers?
Well, it was, and I might say this, under the old system of rotating, I would go into, say, the Fifth Judicial Circuit here, and I would hold all of the circuit court for January, February, March, and April, or September, October, November, and December. I'd be here for 4 months. We'd get well acquainted with the members of the bar, and traditionally, in most of the circuits, they would give the judge a banquet the week he was leaving, in April or in December, as the case might be. And we sort of looked forward to it, and we got acquainted. Now today, a judge doesn't move into any circuit and stay 4 months. He rotates around, and they send other judges in. And I think this tradition of giving a visiting circuit court judge a banquet has pretty well fizzled out. I don't hear tell of it anymore. But everybody today, Pope, is busy. If got nothing else to do, want to go home and look at TV. And so you just don't have the fraternity, you might say, among the lawyers, and among the lawyers on the one hand and the judges on the other hand.
In your book, you mentioned that when you first came to the bar and on the bench, that there were judges who would open court with a prayer, or have a preacher actually come in and say a prayer at the beginning of the court. Was that a practice that existed?
In some counties, it was. It was usually determined by the clerk, or maybe the resident circuit judge. It would establish a custom. In some counties you go to, and when I went on the Supreme Court for several years, we would open the court on Monday morning with a visiting pastor, and sometimes each member of the court would bring his own pastor down to pray. That trickled out of usage. I forget how many years it continued after I went on the Supreme Court. But today, I don't believe it's come into contest and into debate as to whether or not prayer is proper in court. I think it's pretty well out of a custom altogether. But it used to be a great many. Not all counties did it.
Let me ask you this, and you may have read several months ago, there was sort of a brouhaha about a circuit court judge in Richland County not allowing a female lawyer to wear a pantsuit in court. Have you observed a change in the dress that lawyers have in court? And if so, what have you observed about that?
Well, it used to be in the court rule that a man who appeared in court would have to wear a dark coat. And they told a story about one lawyer who came with a checkered, loud coat and apologized to the court for having that kind of coat on. And the Chief Justice is supposed to have said to him, I believe it was Chief Justice Baker, well, we weren't going to mention it, but now that you have called it to our attention, you'll have to go out and borrow a coat and come back in. Later on, that rule was changed where that a man could wear any kind of a suit in the court. And it's, I believe the rule said that lady folks would be appropriately dressed. Until this circuit court judge this very year made an issue of it, I was of the opinion that women had been appearing in court in pantsuits for several years. I couldn't tell you which woman or which court, but I thought that it had been somewhat traditional that they could wear pantsuits. But the judge in Richland County, the circuit court judge in Richland County, took the other view and made an issue of it.
Do you remember lawyers actually wearing, I guess maybe as a child, do you remember lawyers wearing long coats?
No, that was before my time.
Before your time. I seem to remember that you were Chief Justice when two lawyers appeared at the South Carolina Supreme Court to argue a case in blue jeans in the mid-70s. Do you have any recollection of that? And it was a newsworthy event at the time, and there was a lot of talk among the lawyers that these were two lawyers who were sort of liberal free thinkers and showed up in blue jeans to argue. Does that trigger a
recollection? It doesn't ring a bell. It seems like it has some truth to it, but I can't remember enough to talk about it.
Today we have a lot of talk about Rambo-type tactics among lawyers. What was your observation? How did lawyers treat each other in court and out of court when you were on the circuit bench versus what your observation might be today?
Well, I think they were more charitable to each other in days of yore than they are today. there are some counties in this state where lawyers just seem to feud. You have some counties where you have plaintiff's bar and the defendant's bar. Now in Spartanburg, we don't have that distinction. We have some lawyers who practice mostly in defense and some who mostly for the plaintiff. But they don't get labeled like they do, or we'll say, in Charleston or maybe in Columbia. More and more, well, it brings to mind this. Judge Martin, who was a circuit court judge in Greenville, talked to me when I first went on the bench. And he said, you know, more and more lawyers are getting to treat the practice as a business rather than as a profession. And he says you'll find it particularly true in some of the larger counties. And I found it was true. There's a greater tendency to treat it like a business, money-making machine, rather than a profession that we used to think about it in connection with.
What would you say are the good qualities that a circuit judge should possess? Or what are the qualities that make for a good circuit judge?
Well, a lot of people have a definition for the
On next week's episode, Chief Justice Littlejohn discusses the education of lawyers today and his election to the Supreme Court, including his race against then-Circuit Judge Bubba Ness.